I'm sure we have enough members in the meeting. Yes, I can see that we have enough members. Can I request Valerie to confirm, just to confirm that I'm correct?
Morning, Chair. The meeting correct. Just a couple of apologies. Mr. McDonald says there are some connection problems in the village, so he has to find an alternative venue to attend from, so you will be a little bit late. Mr. Oluchungu is not available today, as she submitted an apology. From the department side, it's the Minister and the DG attending Cabinet, and the Deputy Minister have to leave at 12 for a NCOP meeting.
Deputy Minister, morning.
I don't see the DM yet.
The DM is not in the platform yet. She's having network problems. She will connect shortly.
Ah, good man. Hey, this record is broken, Cookie.
It's technology, Chairperson. Thank you.
So the Deputy Minister has double apology. She's having connections problem, and she will also leave earlier. Am I correct, Cookie?
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chairperson. I'm sorry, I was supposed to have spoken to Valerie. At 11:30, I'll be taking a bus to Parliament from the village.
You're not a village.
I'll leave early.
Yeah,
I'm in the village now.
Yeah, village person, you'll connect whilst you are in the bus. Thank you very much. Honorable members, the watch on my desk says it's exactly 9:02. The business of the day today is from 9 to 11, the deliberations on the Civil Aviation Amendment Bill. That is Bill number 44 of 2018 already. It means we are not doing very well when it comes to this bill, but I have all the confidence on the members. Once more, let me greet everybody from all honorable members who are here with us. Officials of the Portfolio Committee, officials of the department, I'm sure they are all listening. Our legal people and everybody, our guests, good morning. I can see Advocate Masombuka saying, yes, I'm listening to you. I hear. Thank you very much, Advocate. And from 11 to 12:45, we'll be deliberating on the economic regulation of Transport Bill, Bill number 1 of 2020. And then, of course, we'll also deal with the minutes of the 17th, and we'll adopt them. Let me take this opportunity then to alert members to the fact that we already have a draft of the minutes of the 19th that will be dealt with at a later stage. And I can say at this stage that our requests for approval that we hold outside our slot, the public hearings on the National Road Traffic Amendment Bill has been approved. So honorable members must prepare themselves from the 10th to the 18th of March, including late evenings on the Tuesday, 11th and the 18th of March. Good morning, members. Advocate.
Good morning, Chair. Good morning, Chair.
Thank you very much. Advocate Almanel is ready and capable of taking us to the next 3-4 hours. Advocate, are you with us?
Yes, Chairperson. Morning, Chair. Morning, members. I just want to take members just slightly back. The department reminded me yesterday of a few additional definition amendments that were raised during the public hearing discussions. So I just want to bring these ones up to the screen for members. So Chairperson, let me just, this is a document I just want members to have a look at quickly. In the discussions, the department indicated the move towards the use of aerodrome. And because of that, there's some consequential amendments that need to be made. So where there is the definition for airport manager, the request is to replace this with aerodrome manager. And this is the proposed wording, means any person appointed in writing by the owner or management of the aerodrome. There's also then a proposed definition to change the definition of designated airport to designated aerodrome. And then we'll see, because of these proposed definition amendments, that was indicated that the department welcomes those submissions from the persons from the floor, that would take consequentially have to be taken through the document. So where we see airport, this will have to change to aerodrome. There was an also because we already passed Clause 8, I just wanted to bring this one up here as well. There was a correction pointed out in the submissions for the reference to the Constitution. And then this one, I think, is our last one that the department just pointed out, is the reference regarding the Tokyo Convention, that there was also an indication from the department that they would agree with that proposed change in the wording. So Chair, I just wanted to highlight those ones before we take up from where we were yesterday.
I can see, Advocate. So you want to hear what our members saying about this?
Yes, Chair. If they're fine with that, then we can make sure that those go into the are added into the A list for members, Chair. It'll just help our drafters so that they have everything and can make those consequential amendments as we work through the document.
Is it not logical that once we have accepted that we're changing from airport to aerodrome, anything that goes for airport will change to aerodrome?
Yes, Chair. It's just that the new definition of the airport manager, when we went through definitions, we didn't read through this one. So I just wanted to point this out to members to note that will need to change, as well as the designated airport changing to designated aerodrome.
Okay, honorable members, let me see members who say they think like me. Ubaba Ulisa, come on.
Chair, thank you. I would have loved to think about you. However, could I possibly ask that we just get quickly, if possible, screened the definition of aerodrome as it stands in the Act, because the dictionary one includes an airport, a major one or whatever. So my view is that, but I don't want to complicate this, is that once you have said aerodrome, you have already included an airport, a big one, OR Tambo, whatever the case may be. Otherwise, then we will get back to what you were making a joke about yesterday, OR Tambo International Aerodrome, Cape Town International Aerodrome, which I don't think that's the route we want to go. I hope I'm not oversimplifying it. But could we just see what is the definition standing now? Is it inclusive of the airport or not? But otherwise, I agree. But I'm just of the view that tomorrow we might find people saying, let's call O.R. Tambo an aerodrome now, and so forth. That is just my view. But generally, I don't think it's a major issue. But I would like us to link it to the definition. Does it include an airport, the definition as it stands now? Thank you, Chair. I hope I am clear.
You are very clear, Jambas. Honorable Hansinger.
Good morning, Chairperson and colleagues. Chairperson, just to start on a lighter note, I enjoyed the deliberation this morning earlier on with Advocate or Mr. Mabasu. In Canada, I never realized that you can also attain jet lag of Zoom meetings since 2 o'clock in the morning. Chairperson, back to work. In terms of the definitions, I'm comfortable with all the definitions, and I therefore propose that we move on. The aerodrome issue, as I understand it, simply is a alignment to international practice in recognizing the bigger infrastructure than simply the airport building. So that by implication, the airport manager is not something that will disappear and become an aerodrome manager. We would still have, you know, substructures having responsibility over particular elements of the bigger drone as such. So I'm comfortable with all of that, but it is challenging and definitely a new concept, which I hope would not lead to name changes because we have to focus on other elements in the budget. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nsinga. Advocate Almanel.
Chair, just for the members, I'm going to try and make it a little bit bigger.
I was saying Honorable Manu had asked.
Yes, Chair. I'm flagging the definition per the Principal Act, Chair.
Yeah. Or you were saying for those of us who are not wearing assistance in our eyes.
Yes, no, or had the benefit of laser eye surgery like myself, Chair.
Yeah, you.
So, Chair, members will see here that it describes an airport, but it doesn't say it includes airport. So this is what is currently in the Principal Act for the definition of an aerodrome.
Chair, if I may, maybe the department can assist us. How does the ICAO define an aerodrome?
Advocate Almanel. Or do you want me to give the department?
Chair, I think Levers has the answer there with his hand raised.
Oh. Well and
thanks, Honorable Chair. Honorable Lisa is quite right. I will try to simplify this so that all the members can understand. It's the similar scenario when we talk of a vehicle, and then when we say a vehicle, it includes buses, it includes sedans, it includes trucks. So that is an aerodrome. It includes airports, it includes heliports, it includes helipads. So when we talk of the critical element word, important word also in that definition is aircraft. So aircraft includes helicopters, it includes aeroplanes. So if it is a place where aircraft can land, that will include where helicopters can land, where aeroplanes can land. That is an aerodrome. So if it's only an area where only helicopters can land, and then it's helipad. So that's the thing. So now when we talk about an aerodrome, So it is those areas where we will talk about an area where any aircraft can land. So ICAO defines the aerodrome as it is defined now in the Act. So however, they ask, I had Advocate Nell indicating that we'll change airport to aerodrome wherever it appears. There is only one area where it should deliberately be left as such, and I will point it to the committee when we arrive there, because we also need to maintain the word airport and the word heliport in the Act, because when we now drill down to the regulations, there are certain provisions that only apply to the airport. And then if we are to use the word aerodrome only for those applying to the airport, by implication, we'll be making those apply to heliports, which becomes an impossibility. Thanks, Honorable Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mang.
Thank you, Chair. With that explanation, I therefore move that we do not change, as suggested, anything to aerodrome manager. We keep it as it is. However, the rest of the proposals as presented, that we carry through. Thank you, Chairperson.
Yeah. You are proposing that when we get to the specifics, as Livers is saying, we should retain the word airport as it is needed. Am I hearing you saying so?
No, thank you, Chairperson. Not really. As Advocate Nell was presenting this morning, she was alluding to the fact that she was reminded by the department that there were specific recommendations which the department was willing to carry through, which she then read through. I then asked the question, when it was proposed that instead of an airport manager, we call it an aerodrome manager. I think that is where it was at. You then said, isn't it automatic that every word will change to aerodrome instead of airport? So I think that is where the clarity is. If I hear the man from Canada early in the morning, there is that we still need to keep the word airport so that we don't complicate ourselves further down. So if my understanding is correct, therefore, I would move, as I said, that we retain the definition as it is now of the airport manager, and the rest of the other definitions, we then effect the recommendations as suggested by the presenters and supported by the department. Thank you, Chair.
Let's hear the man from Canada giving some clarity on that one. Leave us.
Thanks, Honorable Chair, and apologies for coming. The definition of aerodrome manager, I think I recommend that the committee adopts it, because even all aerodromes need to have managers. So if we only restrict it to airport manager, it means the heliports will not need to have a manager. Or then when we want to talk about the heliport manager, and then we will use a different word, because for the purpose of aerodrome manager, it goes with the designation which the minister has to do. So now in the previous in the current act as it is, it was only the airport which could be designated. So now we are moving. We also want the minister can decide to designate any aerodrome. So that's where the responsibility of the aerodrome manager will come in. So the designation for the benefit of the house is to require that aerodrome to have added security measures. Thank you.
I hear you very well, Livers. Mira Madwa.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson and Macheron. Chairperson, I raised my hand before the man from Canada because I wanted to indicate that at the airport, the helicopters and the aeroplanes land there. So it means the manager must manage everything in that area. I think we need to leave aerodrome manager as it is like that. And then to the specific to others, then that we can change according to what is it, according to the specification in that area. Then that we can change. But in this one, I think we can say aerodrome manager, so that he manages everything that will land there. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think we will run into trouble if we decide on the inclusion of a aerodrome manager. And I believe we will run into trouble simply for the following reasons. Aerodrome, in terms of alignment to ICAO, means a reference to a particular area on land, or water for that matter, which then includes the arrival, departure, and surface movement of aircraft. So it refers to a geographical area and a particular location on the surface, on land. So if through defining a role as an aerodrome manager is specified and through the minister appointed, who will that person be, given that within this aerodrome, we've got a role of AXA, we've got a role of ATNS, we've got a role of SAPS, we've got a role of defense. So who will then be in charge of this geographical surface? So I think we must accept alignment in terms of definition in including aerodrome as a reference to a particular area and surface to align with ICAO, but we should not engage in the appointment or inclusion of an aerodrome manager at this stage. Let us take the first step in accepting aerodrome as a particular movement in alignment of international trend and compliance. But let's hang on to the manager of an aerodrome, because it would complicate the current situation in having AXA, ATNS, SAPS, and in some cases defense as part of this geographical space. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, Babu Ketamaba, aerodrome, Baba, it can't be. I can naturally remember, and I can go port. Pamsi, the Gitoko Noti, you are also Cheramiti. Baba Ketamaba was taller, Utala Tel Andre. Yahoo.
Oma was in a corner for Stadler.
No. You are protected, Honorable Member.
Chairperson, actually, it is now after the definition by Lever. It is actually confusing, because according to what he said, he says some aeroplanes will be used. Aeroplane weight will be used instead of aerodrome. So now what I'm trying to check now, actually, where are we going to use and when are we going to use the aeroplane and when are we going to use aerodrome?
No, not aeroplane, airport.
Airport, yeah, airport. Because it says the airport, we are going to use the airport. So now I'm trying to check now because it's confusing the whole situation. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Ngwane, so ngangena ke ba.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Chairperson. You must know that I must speak before Mr. Ketamabala because of seniority.
Okay.
I would like to align myself with Ne Ramadwa that we should accept the weight Iroto. We have already accepted the weight, but if at all we are going to get into trouble, I don't know who's going to take us to trouble because we're in charge here. But anyway, if we can't reach a consensus, it would be appropriate that we should ask the government, the department, to come with a proper definition. Thank you, sir.
Okay, thank you. I think the issue here, as Honorable Stole is lowering his hand, that I would want the department to quickly clarify. When we say in areas where we are using the word aerodrome, the airport manager should be changed to aerodrome manager. An honorable member by the name of Chris Unsinga is saying, as lovers have said, the word aerodrome is inclusive of other activities, and he mentioned them. Now, is the department's intention that that manager will be overseeing all those like helipad and so forth and so on? I think that's the clarity we should seek so that we clearly deal with this proposal. Advocate Masombuga or Oliver Zukon. Livers?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Firstly, as I've alluded to the issue of the designation, that is where now the responsibilities of the aerodrome manager comes in, is after the minister has designated that aerodrome as a designated aerodrome, which means then there are additional security responsibilities that aerodrome has to undertake. So one of them is to designate a person in writing from that aerodrome as an aerodrome manager for that purpose. So it's for the purposes as outlined in the Act, so not for other purposes. So we're not trying to redefine what the person should do in the whole aerodrome. There are specific responsibilities which are contained in the Act, which requires the designated aerodrome to have a person designated as an aerodrome manager to be able to perform that. So the scenario that is put by Honorable Hansinger, when it comes to the aerodrome, that area is managed by the aerodrome operator. So the others are tenants within the aerodrome in the sphere of this particular legislation. So there are clear demarcation of responsibilities. It will not create any challenges in the application. So the responsibility to have an aerodrome manager is when the aerodrome has been designated as a designated aerodrome, where they now have to have a national aviation security program for that particular aerodrome. So the designation will not apply to helipads. So where I indicated so that the members should not be confused, that it's only one area where the department deliberately left the use of the words airport and helipad. It's only in one area so as to maintain these words, because then there is also, there was a proposal to this committee that we need to delete the definition of airport and the definition of heliport since they are included in aerodrome. So then our response was that we do not have to delete them, because when we go into the regulations, there are specific provisions that only apply to airports, and there are specific provisions that only apply to heliports. So if we now, when we go to those provisions and then we say aerodromes, for instance, to give a practical example, if we say the aerodrome must have a runway which is not shorter than 1 kilometer in length, so we use the word aerodrome. So it does not apply to heliports, because the heliports do not need that kind of a runway, because helicopters do not need that long runway to be able to take off. So that's the thing. We should not forget the responsibility of an aerodrome manager are provided for in the Act, but for those aerodromes which are designated by the minister as designated aerodromes. So there will not be any confusion. So it's not for any aerodrome except only those that are designated. Thank you.
Okay, Lavas. Let's go back, Alma. Advocate Alma.
Yes, Chair.
Can we go back to the yellow painted writings here? Lavas, are you there?
Yes, Honorable Chair.
Yes. Where are you in the whole issue here? Has that designated any other airport? That's where your issue is. You're saying what must change there?
Honorable Chair, the definition will still remain as a definition of a designated aerodrome. Okay.
Designated aerodrome is number
two. Yeah, because the last point I made was in relation to one, the definition of airport. Oh, no, this is airport manager. There was a proposal where it was...
number three. Go to number three. Yeah, there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Read that and check whether it is in tandem with what you are saying.
Okay.
Network.
Honorable Chair, I think what perhaps might not have come up clear is that, yes, the ideal situation will be for the purposes of this Act, it will be ideal to replace where we had airport or heliport to replace them with aerodrome wherever it appears. So, and then in that doing, it made the definition of an airport to be redundant in that the word would not be used in the act, and you cannot define something that is not used in the act.
So, okay.
Yes.
Okay. So, give me an opportunity so that we can close this letter.
Yes.
This what we see here, according to Advocate Almanel,
yes,
is what comes from the department where you are an official, the Department of Transport. I don't wish to say there is contradiction in that department, but I wish to say, because this thing is here, what is your proposal? How do we remain with the word airport for the purpose of regulations, as you said? How should that paragraph read? That's what I'm trying to zoom in. I'm not contesting what you are saying. Instead, I'm saying let's help each other to formulate that sentence proper, that paragraph proper, so that we can move. Let me suggest Advocate Almanel. Advocate Almanel?
Yes, Chair.
Can we at this stage proceed with our business today? Let the department engage, because I think it is them that must give us a proper direction. On that number three issue, so that as we engage, I don't think we have many issues. It's just that they themselves do not agree when it comes to number three, as I listen to them.
Chair, I think the clarity that might assist that we need, they do have the definition of airport.
Mm-hmm.
They did propose a change in the definition of airport. I'm just going to put it on the screen here quickly, Chair. So Chair, we'll see. Yesterday, members agreed to this proposed change of the definition of airport.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that the explanation will be suited because we don't have here a change in I just want to get where D would be. There's no designated aerodrome definition proposed in the bill, whereas in the Act, just want to get to the principal Act definitions. I think it's all about the use of designated airport or designated aerodrome.
So you are saying...
You see, Chair, in the Principal Act, they had designated airport.
Mm-hmm.
So this includes the airport, heli-stop, heliport, as designated by the minister. Mm-hmm. So if we follow the change proposed to airport, which will change to demarcated area, and then we include the aerodrome is already there. So if we have a designated aerodrome, which is something like OR Tambo,
mm-hmm.
then the designated aerodrome change can apply throughout the bill. So you'll have consequential amendments there. So it does seem like there's a proposal to remove use of designated airport, because the move is towards having designated aerodromes instead of designated airports.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean we take away the definition of airport altogether, because we already have it here. It's just to make sure that once you have an aerodrome space set up, that it follows that wherever there's reference to the designated airport, we change it to designated aerodrome. I think it's not that if we follow the proposals that it's going to be a blanket application to all the airports. That's what I would think. But if you want the department to just clarify that at the next meeting, I'm happy to carry on from clause 14 where we left off yesterday, Chair.
Okay. Leavers, you are now clarified, I hope. This is what you are saying.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Yes. So when on that definition of designated aerodrome, we will just delete helipad. So then it will include airport and heliport. So that's the only area where we'll maintain the word heliport and airport. And then the other areas we can use aerodrome. So I think, yes, it's accommodated in that one.
Accommodated. Thank you very much. I think with that, we can now move to the next. Unless there's a hand, Honorable Chris Hansinger, I can see your hand is up.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm comfortable that we move on. Just a quick question to Mr. Mabasu. Do we have an cow reference or criteria that would give us insight as to the procedure to follow for a particular location that seeks or would qualify to be called an aerodrome? Is there a criteria and a procedure? Because that would then also support the problem that we have in, calling everything suddenly an aerodrome, whereas it is a particular definition with particular content and a particular status. So is there a procedure or a criteria according to which the infrastructure would qualify to be called an aerodrome so that we can exclude some potential airports that need to be classified as such and others that would stay? So is there such a classification, categories, criteria, procedure? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Lovers?
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Yes, there is. In addition to the standards, we also have guidance material, so I can source them out for the committee if the committee so wish.
So that the committee is very clear. But I think by and large we agree on the issue we're discussing. As you source out for information, I think it will be nice. Leave us. Advocate. Almanel.
Chair, just getting my screen share up. Okay, Chair, carrying on from yesterday, we are at clause 14. Clause 14 seeks to amend section 76, some of the subsections. Section 76 deals with the functions and responsibility of the Civil Aviation Board. That's the corporate governance, their responsibilities of SACA, and who the accounting authority is of SACA. And how they execute their responsibilities, and that they will not be personally liable. Okay, Chair, just getting here, 76. So we are there's a proposal for an amendment to subsection 2A. It seems like it's just a grammatical substitution here to determine, oversee and review instead of revise. The corporate governance structures. The next one is at D, to change reference here just to say to determine the policy for conditions of employment and remuneration, allowances, subsidies, and other service benefits of employees of the Civil Aviation Authority. The proposal is to remove the reference here to other than the director. The next proposed amendment here, Chair, is at subsection 4 in the execution of the responsibilities as contemplated in subsections 2 and 3. The Civil Aviation Authority Board may not compromise or obstruct the execution of the safety, security, and environmental protection oversight functions of the Commissioner. So, Chair, the environmental protection is a consequential amendment from the ones we saw yesterday, as well as the reference where the director's reference has changed to commissioner. So, Chair, if members are all right with that clause, we can go to the next one, Chair.
Cannot talk on behalf of members. Let me see if members are all right. I'm with them. Can we see hands? If members are all right, I want to see that the indication. Honorable Ulisa Wakwamani Chambers.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. I propose we accept that last submission and we move on, Chair. Thank you.
Masibulele Mhlekazi. Any hand that second? There we are, Honorable Chris Hunsinger. Any hand that is not in line with what we are saying? It's correct. Anybody who has a problem with this one? No one. Thank you, Advocate Almanel. You can continue.
Thank you, Chair. Our next one is Clause 15, seeks to amend Section 77. Section 77 deals with the appointment of members of the Civil Aviation Authority Board. So, Chair, the proposed amendment here is to subsection 1, paragraphs A and B, to change A to 1 must be the non-executive chairperson who is appointed for a term not exceeding 3 years and shall on the expiration of such term be eligible for reappointment for one further term only. B, 1 must be an employee of the department, and if the minister specifies an office in the department for the purpose of this subsection, the person for the time being holding that office. So, Chair, that will change these two clauses in the Principal Act. Then the next one is a proposed amendment to sub F. One must be a person with civil aviation technical competencies instead of civil aviation acknowledged or involved in organized labor from aviation industry. So, Chair, if used to read, one must be a person with civil aviation acknowledged technical competencies involved in organized labor from the aviation industry. So this is the proposed change, just that person must be have civil aviation technical competencies. Back to you, Chairperson.
Advocate Almanel, I appreciate the fact that you bring my reins back so that I can give them back to the owners. Let's hear, honorable members, happy, any other issue? If members are happy, let me see such a proposal. Ubaba Ulisa Ujambas.
Yes, Chair, I propose we accept the proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am. Mondes?
I second, sir.
Thank you very much. Anybody who is not in agreement? Nobody, as the Honorable Mangu is lowering his hand. Thank you very much, Advocate. Can we move?
Chair, our next clause, clause 16, will amend section 82. Section 82 is on the remuneration of members of the Civil Aviation Board. So the proposed amendment is a substitution of subsection 2. So Chair, just to show members, subsection 2 read, an appointed member who is in full-time service of the state is not, in respect of the duties performed by him or her as a member, paid any remuneration in addition to his or her remuneration and allowance in respect of subsistence and travel at a rate higher than applicable to him or her for that office. So the change is proposed. An appointed member who holds any post or office in or under any government entity, administration or department, or in or under any institution or body that is wholly or partially funded by the state, is not, in respect of their duties performed by him or her as a member, entitled to any payment. Chair, that is one of the clauses that they have brought in so that members that are already in the public service and an employee of government under the public service are normally not remunerated for serving on boards. So that is up for members' consideration before we move on, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate, for that. Ubaba Uchamba, Uhamba Pambi.
I support the proposal. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Jobe. Jambas. Bora Madwa.
No, Livua. Ndiko tikedza bo Honorable Mangu. I second Honorable Mangu.
Otikedza bo Honorable Mangu. Your secondi. Babu Stole, thank you very much, Honorable Member. Babu Stole, Jobe.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm not supporting or not or support, but I'm trying to check if an official is serving in the board according to this new amendment. It says he won't be paid. What I'm trying to check, if that person or official have specific knowledge on that the airport. Do you mean that if he's saving the port, he won't be paid? That's what I'm trying to check.
Because he's using the department's time to serve the port. Honorable man, and is paid during that time. But let me hear the legal people. Baba Masombu, why are you not paying the people when they serve in the board?
Chairperson, because they claim SNT from their places of employment. Remember, they must also, it's either they are appointed by the department or they seek permission from their entities. And they are paid in SNTs from their places of employment.
Mm. That's what I'm. Okay. Job so is really like employed.
No, I hear, but my query, Chairperson, is that one. How are we going to penalize that person if he is saving somewhere else, and then when he's supposed to come to the port, and if he don't come? Because he is not been paid by that specific airport.
Okay. Ngathi babu manje ufuna ukuphendula.
Ngiyabonga. Ngiyabonga Sihlalo. Jobe. The person who is in that board is selected or nominated in his or her capacity as that official in the department. Therefore, that person could not have been in that board through the department if they were not nominated by the minister to serve and represent the shareholder there. So when they go to the board, it is part of their responsibilities. Now, if they do not go, it is as the same as somebody didn't rock up at work. The same process and procedure should follow. Thank you, Chairperson.
Jobe, uzwila ngithi mfowethu.
Ngizwile mfowethu.
So ya supporta manje.
Ari zobuya nje kimi ne aerodrome buni yabuya manje kade nithana anibon guys.
No, unga revenge Mondisi. Okay. Advocate, can we move?
Okay, Chair, our next clause, clause 17, is a proposed repeal of section 83 of the Principal Act. So this clause is asking members to completely remove section 83 on corporate governance. So Chair, the section read, the Civil Aviation Authority Board must annually submit to the minister a corporate governance plan in respect of the ensuing financial year and each of the three immediate following financial years, containing the information taken into account, the terms of the performance agreement contemplated in section 94, as the minister or the minister of finance may require, and the structure of the corporate governance plan, the procedure for approval by the minister and consultation requirements in respect of that plan must be contained in the performance agreement contemplated in section 94. So Chair, the request for members to consider is the total removal of this clause on the corporate governance plan.
Honorable members? Are we okay to remove? Oba wakete mabala, alandelo u jambas.
Chair, I understand the removal of that one, but I'm trying to check. There is no replacement of the clause. It is just a removal of clause 83, and then it ends there.
Advocate Alma?
Chair, I believe the department will be able to indicate here where the corporate governance plan is catered for elsewhere, and or they might just refer members to the memorandum. If I scroll down to the memorandum, it's going to take me a little bit of a while to get back here, Chair.
Maybe let's get straight to the department then. I'm coming to you, Jambas. Baba Masombu.
Thanks, Chairperson. In our memo, we explained that to say clause 17 repeals section 83 of the Act. This is intended to bring the Act in line with the Public Finance Management Act, 1 of 1999. The Civil Aviation Authority does not fall under the list of public entities that are required by PFMA to submit a corporate governance plan. So that is why that has been removed. Thank you, Chairperson.
Uzwile job.
As a manager.
Siyabonga mfowethu. Jambas.
I'm okay, Chair. I lower my hand. I'm covered. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So we can move.
And I do support the removal, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody who does not support, and the reasons why is he or she not supporting, going once, twice. Thank you very much. Advocate Almane.
Chairperson, our next one, clause 18, seeks to give an entirely new section 85 to the Principal Act. So the Principal Act Section 85 deals with the appointment and removal of a director of the Civil Aviation Authority. Chair, this is also the director's change to the commissioner. So we'll see now, this is where the change also comes in. So the new 85 will then refer to an appointment and removal of commissioner. The minister must appoint a commissioner from a list of no more than three names recommended by the Civil Aviation Authority Board in accordance with prescribed procedures. Chair, so I want to save some time. I'm just going to flag or show the full clause on the screen. It's quite a substantive clause. And then the Civil Aviation Authority Board may suspend the commissioner pending the outcome of an investigation. That is the bottom of that one, whereas the old 85 was very short, Chair. So the new one has quite a few more provisions in it. So I'm just going to put it on the screen, Chair, for yourself and members to consider this new addition.
That is Section 85, Clause 18. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Honorable members, let's talk. We Ubaba Uchambase.
Thank you, Chair. I think there is two, if I had Advocate. Well, the first one is 85.1. Says the minister must appoint a commissioner from a list of no more than three names recommended by the Civil Aviation Authority Board. And then it carries on. In terms of that one, I'm in full support. And I think the second one is saying the Civil Aviation Authority Board may suspend the commissioner pending the outcome of an investigation. And for that one also, I support. I'm not sure where the eight that Chair is talking about, but I saw those are the two ones, and I think they are very straightforward, and I move that we support them.
Thank you very much, Chambers.
Chair, if I can just clarify, it's this entire 85, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. I just read 1 and 11 to show members how far down it goes. It's not just two amendments, it's this whole clause that's in front of members that's going to be proposed to be added.
And that is Section 85?
Yes, it's the new 85.
That's where the 8 is coming from.
Chair, I get it, and I withdraw my earlier comments. I think I didn't see the line going down on the right. I just concentrated on the underlined portions. Please accept my apology, Chair. I withdraw my earlier comments. And I would want rather that we apply our mind a little bit more. As Advocate says, it's a bit long. Maybe we take it line by line quickly. I like just knowing what is it changing from, but as Advocate says, it's a total new one. So I concentrated on those two lines. So I'm not really now moving for it to go forward. I would rather look at it quickly, scan through it. Thank you, Chair. And lastly, I withdraw my earlier comment. Chair, I hope you accept my apology.
I always accept your apology, Chambers. As my pastor, I don't have a right not to accept. Thank you very much. Advocate?
Chair, this is an appointment that the minister would do if I have to give an example. It's similar to appointments of a DG. Or a CEO in some instances, for example, group CEOs, normally the board will sit and they will call for the nominations, do the interviews and shortlisting, submit the shortlist to the minister, who will then make and agree to those appointments. And in most recent years, even though it's not always contained in legislation, the minister would even go so far as to take those proposed names to cabinet to get buy-in from cabinet for those appointments. In the provinces, I know that the premier's office is also then involved in the appointment of HODs. So this follows suit to what is in practice. Just to show members the old clause that is being replaced. So it's the minister calls for nominations in the media, compiles the shortlist for the appointments, after receipt of comments and evaluation of the persons, the minister then appoints and notifies Parliament within 30 days of that appointment. And when appointing the director, the minister must take into account the following factors. So the factors is their skills, their knowledge, the period that they'll hold, the office is included here. A fit and proper person is the same. It's similar to what we have in board appointments in any event. And then the removal from the office.
Yes.
It's basically, if we look at it, it's still 5 years in the new one. It's just changed from director to commissioner. The old one was also not exceeding 5 years. But there's a difference here in the sense that the minister now gets the nominees from the Civil Aviation Board, and it's not the minister who then calls for the nominations directly. So the rest of those items are quite similar to the old one, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Let me go back to the members. I'm sure they have had some time to peruse. Baba Ulisa Wakwamani.
Thank you very much, Chair, for indulgence. Thank you, Advocate. Can I just seek clarity in subsection one, I think? Says the commissioner must be a South African citizen who is a fit and proper person. When we talk about South African citizen, I want to check if I'm correct. We are including naturalized or born and bred in South Africa. Is that how it is supposed to be? That's number one. Number two, I never see, even in the appointment of boards and so forth, and I think it's something that we should consider, unless it is not supposed to be in the Act, the fact that people need to have a particular level of security clearance. I think that's something that has exposed us quite a lot. Well, now I'm saying it's government. So I just seek clarity on the current one, seven. Who are we talking to about the South African? Anybody? You've got permanent residents. You've got naturalized. Does that include you? And number two, which is not currently in front of us. It is my view that somewhere, and I'm not necessarily insisting that it be in the Act, but I want to deposit for some processing, Chair, through you, that I think the importance of people being cleared security-wise is very, very important. Other than that, all the other clauses, I'm very fine, Chair, to support. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Jambas. Thank you, Shati. Okay. Let's clarify on this one. Fit and proper South African citizen. Does it include a naturalized citizen? Advocate Masumbuga. I can see Advocate Almanel is doing something here, highlighting. dear South African. Asiya Baba Mazumbu.
Thanks, Chairperson. Fit and proper will refer to a person who's having all the requirements of being a South African, and any other requirements that warrant him to can be appointed to the to the to that particular position. Thank you.
South African, South African citizen. What is the meaning thereof? Advocate Mazumbuga.
Yes, Chairperson.
What is the meaning of South African? Does it include naturalized South African citizens?
Well, Chairperson, if they are having the required documentation to that refers them or refers them as South Africans, then they will qualify.
I'm requesting you humbly, Advocate Masombo, not to run away from this issue. I can see you are hearing where we are going. In this case, is a naturalized South African, a former citizen of another country, because of his or her naturality now, qualifying to be here and to be fit and proper because of that? I think that's the clear question. Yes or no?
Chairperson, I will say yes.
Okay. I think Honorable Manu has got it. Is this a practice in other countries, Advocate? Can we learn from other countries when it comes to this?
Chairperson, I'm not sure about other countries, but the question would be, that will provide an answer, would be, what is the purpose of naturalizing people? In essence, you are naturalizing them so that they can be proper, fit and proper South African citizens and qualify to have all rights and benefits that are for South African citizens.
Mm. They can vote, they can do everything. Therefore, they are South African citizens. They can be elected to hold an office. Yes, Advocate, it's not your mistake. I hear what you are telling us. Thank you very much, Honorable Manu.
And they can also be the head of the SSA. Yeah, but anyway, Chair, the second part, maybe I had the response. Thank you, Advocate. The second part of my question, and again, as I said, I'm not suggesting it here, but I think it's an important part to be included as a proposal, if it's already not highlighted. Thank you, Chair.
The security clearance issue. Baba, we're provoking somebody. Honorable Makosini, and after you, Baba Ketamaban.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I don't know if I would be irrelevant, but if I'm irrelevant, you must call me to order. I think it should also be specifically indicated that the shortlisted should comprise of qualified candidates for the specific job. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Shabangu. Baba Uketa Mabala was told.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I think your question and Honorable Magnus' question is actually not been answered. Because I'm trying to check, the advocate is trying to actually to run away from the question. Because, Chair, I see that you are trying even yourself to check our constitutionality. But I'm worried, Chair, because when we are saying everybody who has been naturalized can be appointed, it means we are saying even the aviation can be head by somebody who's from other countries. I'm trying to check, Chairperson, when your question says which country has practiced this act, he says no country, no. But how can they put something that they is not been actually experienced somewhere? Thank you, Chair.
No, it's okay. I think let's leave this issue, honorable members. It's not a big issue. I think advocate is correct to say we ourselves as honorable members belongs to the generation of our constitution. And once somebody has been naturalized, they enjoy all what we are enjoying. Let me take the last person on this one, Advocate Frank K. Jenkins.
Good morning, Chairperson. Let me just switch on my video. And honorable members, I'm just trying to help quickly with this one. I'll lower my hand. Chair, there is in section 110 of the Civil Aviation Act, they refer to section 2 of the South African Citizenship Act as a definition for what is a citizen. And I can only assume that it applies to the whole act as well as the bill that will come in. And there's certain areas in South Africa, and this is sort of on the side where when it comes to certain rights, permanent residents and South African citizens are on the same page. Of course, that's not voting rights, but certain employment rights. If you're a permanent resident, you can work here. But when it comes to citizenship, you must have the citizens. It's not just an ID number. You must have the citizenship, whether you're naturalized or whether you're born in the country, it will be the same. There will be no discrimination once you have the citizenship. So I just wanted to clarify that. And it is a reference to the Citizenship Act. So it's not just hanging in the air, Chair. I just wanted to help the commission. Of the committee there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Can we now move? Babu Stowell.
You can explain what is the citizenship? What does it do?
Yeah. Citizen. Okay. Advocate Jay Jenkins, could you be so kind to educate us a bit?
Chair, the citizenship, if you're born in the country, I'm going to keep it short. There are certain countries that determine citizenship by your place of birth. If you're born in a country, you will have citizenship there. Mm-hmm. Yes, you see some people on the 7th or 8th month of pregnancy fly to England, Chairperson. This is true, to get that British citizenship. Now, in South Africa, it works the same. If you're born in South Africa, unless you're a diplomat, you will be a citizen automatically. If you're not born here, if you come here and you have a work permit, there's certain requirements. You can work for 5 years, you invest a certain amount, you can get permanent residence. Once you have permanent residence, you can apply after 2 to 3 years to become a citizen, and you'll have to take an oath to swear faithfulness to the Constitution and to the Republic, Chairperson. And then you've sworn allegiance to the country, and if you comply with the Act, you get your citizenship, which then will entitle you to the rights of a citizen, which includes voting, for instance, although you might have been born elsewhere. So that's the citizenship. It's a status that will, of course, always allow you to return to the country. The Constitution does not allow people with citizenship to be excluded from the country, and that is because of the apartheid laws, Chairperson. So I'm just trying to quickly set out what does it mean, what rights, what's the implications of having the citizen. If you're a permanent resident and you create certain offenses, your permanent residence can be withdrawn. Citizenship cannot be withdrawn. You cannot be made stateless if you're South African. You cannot be withdrawn, Chairperson. she's almost fighting. She got all the things there, Chairperson. So I'm going to leave it there. I'm being assisted here by my colleague. Thank you, Chair.
Listen to the Chairperson. Will never go wrong. Advocate Alma.
Chair, I just quickly pulled the act from Google. It's quite a long act. Yeah. It's normally, even in the Companies Act, they will also refer for the appointment to the definition of a citizen in terms of the South African Citizenship Act. So like Advocate Jenkins said, it's by birth, and then it clarifies how that works, by descent, by naturalization.
That is the one we're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah.
So there's the naturalization one.
Mm-hmm.
So this is normally whenever there's reference to a requirement for having South African citizenship, it will always go back here to the Citizenship Act, and then also it indicates here when loss of citizenship does come into it, and renunciation thereof.
I
hope that one assists for members there. Then, Chair, just on the other question, the new proposed subclause 7 does also require for this commissioner to obtain a top secret security clearance. So I hope that will also assist Mr. Manku with his question there, Chair.
Top secret. What is the meaning of top secret?
I might have to pull the State Security Act then, Chair. Top secret is normally the documents that even go towards cabinet will have top secret documents that is also required for airspace and airspace movement, Chair. So some dignitaries that do come in sometimes when the president's also on route somewhere, that the information won't necessarily be public information. But it's normally to cover those top secret incidents, possible incidents that might come from state security towards the airport. So the commissioner will definitely have to have top secret security clearance as the highest form of security clearance issued by the state security chair.
Thank you very much. I think with that, members were agreeing. Can we see anybody who still have an issue going once? Twice. Thank you very much. Advocate Alma, we can move.
Okay, Chair, our next one is clause 19. That also now substitutes the old section 86. This is more in line with the change of the word director to commissioner. So the old 86 is the duties of the director. And our new one will be the duties of commissioner. The commissioner then here also just at the end, accountable to the minister in respect of issues relating to civil aviation security, safety, security, and environmental protection. Again, the environmental protection is consequential to the previous ones. And then subsection 4, the commissioner must submit a quarterly report to the minister on the execution of his or her duties. Just to look at the old ones, 3A did not have the environmental protection issues here. And the old one required the board to submit quarterly reports to the board, the director to submit to the board, whereas now the commissioner will submit to the minister. Chair, I just want to flag this one. The minister does do the appointment in terms of the new 85, but it is the Civil Aviation Board that pulls the names. So the department can just say why they are proposing the change in focus here now again to the minister. I think it's just consequential because if you move from a board appointment to a ministerial appointment, then you will have this kind of change. So that would be clause 19C, changing section 86.
Thank you, Advocate Almanel. Let's see hands. Any proposal? Baba Kalisa, Baba Lisa, Kamani.
Chairperson, thank you. Thank you, Advocate. Other than what the good advocate has said, I was going to ask that clarity also. But I'm happy to propose to the committee that we accept Clause 19 as presented to us. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chambers. Boramada?
Thank you, Chairperson. I second the proposal by Honorable Member.
Thank you very much. Anybody who, as you both lower your hands, good Honorable Members, thank you very much for your kindness. Anybody who is not in agreement, thank you very much. Advocate, back to you.
Our next one is the substitution of section 90. So we're at clause 20 now. But just before we get to 90, obviously members, throughout the act, we will have these consequential amendments. For example, in section 87, the reference to director will change to commissioner. The same here under powers of director. So I just wanted to point that out to members. I'm sure our drafters are on it, or they will be on it if it has not already shown up in the bill, to have those consequential amendments throughout the document. So Chair, section 90 dealt with the appointment of an acting director. So Chair, there was six subsections to 90, and the proposed amendment is that it's now changed to appointment of acting commissioner when the commissioner is absent from the Republic or is otherwise unable to fulfill the duties of the commissioner. The commissioner must, having regard to section 85.2, appoint a member of the staff of the Civil Aviation Authority to act as commissioner. The period of appointment of an acting commissioner in subsection 1 may not exceed 30 days. And then the minister must appoint an acting commissioner in case of a vacancy in the office of the commissioner or any period of absence exceeding 30 days. So Chair would see the old one is quite similar. It's again vacancies, absences of 30 days. It was also an appointment by the minister here or by the director of a member of staff. The only thing that differs here, Chair, we just need to make sure that this is a full substitution of section 90, and that will just be these three subsections. So it does not have the old ones, the old reference to if they are appointed, it must not continue for more than 12 months. That would be the acting appointment done by the minister. They hold the same responsibilities, powers and functions, and also should not be longer than the 30 consecutive days. If it is, they must be paid such remuneration and allowances as the minister determines. So we just need the department to indicate that the intention is to have this be the new section 90, and that 4, 5 and 6 will also fall away. Back to you, Chairperson.
Advocate, let me see my members in the house. Ubaba Ulisa, come on, please.
Chair, thank you very much again. Thank you, Advocate.
I think the last issues you raised are things that I was also going to raise in terms of understanding other things. But that Section 85.2 that you are saying, having regard of Section 85.2, one, what does it say? Because I think it might have implication on my concern there. And my concern is the following. If we specifically prescribe the commissioner what he or she should be, I'm assuming, not having a knowledge or understanding of what Section 85.2, that any other position within the Civil Aviation Authority would not have prescribed the issues that I raised for the appointment of a commissioner. Therefore, if I am correct, again, my disclaimer is that I'm not sure what Section 85.2 is saying. It means that you might end up with a acting commissioner for a period not exceeding 30 days who doesn't meet those the particular qualifications that were imposed upon the appointment of a commissioner. That is the clarity I'm seeking. And if therefore I'm correct, I will have a fundamental issue with this clause not prescribing the type of person that should therefore be appointed as an acting commissioner. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chambers. Can we have an assistance in terms of clarifying this matter? Advocate Almanel.
Chair, I'm just putting on screen what is contained in the new 85.2. When appointing the commissioner in terms of subsection 1, the minister must take into account such person's management and aviation technical knowledge and experience. Currently, that is what the proposed new 85.2 should read, Chairperson. If we go to the old one, or the old clause, which was 85. Just want to get the experience here. That would have been under 85.3A, such person's management and aviation technical knowledge and experience, mm-hmm. and such person's suitability and competence for the efficient discharge of the director's powers and functions. So that's what the old bill, the old act read. And the new one just refers to aviation management and aviation technical knowledge and experience.
Are you done, Advocate?
Chair, I think just the department can just indicate to members when it comes to acting appointments. I do note the concern by the member that if you are doing an acting appointment, if you remove the linkage to those skills that is required to have the actual post filled, should it not be in here as well? And if we look at the old 90, this one just says here in 5, a person appointed has the responsibilities, powers, and functions, but it doesn't necessarily refer to the skills or should need similar skills. I want to say it's almost a given practice, Chairperson, but sometimes it's not possible to have the same person within Civil Aviation Authority that's acting to have the exact same skills. So the department can just come in here to clarify for members' concern.
Thank you, Advocate. Advocate Masombuga, Mastroko Zeba.
Thank you, Chairperson. Our position is that Section 85.2 specify what the minister should take into account when appointing that particular acting person. And what must he do? He must take into account such person's management and aviation technical knowledge and experience.
Are you done, Advocate?
Yes, Chairperson.
You are mean today. Thank you very much. Ubaba Utami, Kama Pena.
I think I just want clarity in terms of experience. It says the person must have aviation technical knowledge and experience, and also they must take into account his management skills. But now, in terms of experience, it's not explicit. It just says experience. Just for argument's sake, Chair, I'm not trying to be difficult, but I would argue if I was employed in the aviation sector and I was fired, or if I was, for instance, Honorable Seth Van Rooyen, we can argue that he's an experienced finance minister, even though he served, for those many hours as a finance minister. But in the definition of this act, one would argue and say, no, Honorable Seth Van Rooyen also has experience. He's not definitive in terms of how long or what type of experience does that person have. In terms of technical knowledge, management skills, yes, technical knowledge can, obviously, that person is suitably qualified. And, or perhaps the amendment can read to say sufficient experience. But also, if it says sufficient experience, it's also not definitive. It doesn't give us almost a direction. And making an example with Honorable Des Van Rooyen, he has a master's degree. So we can argue that he has the technical knowledge and is qualified, but the experience part, one can say, no, he doesn't have experience or sufficient experience in that position. So I'm not sure if maybe this is, like, I just need clarity, Chair, if maybe I can be assisted there. Thanks. Apologies for me, Chair, always honorable fundraising. I just wanted to make my point across.
Okay. Ubaba Umanu.
Thank you very much, Chair, again, for your indulgence. Chair, going back to the response by the good advocate Masombuga, I think it amplifies my point that I'm not in support that any person who would be acting would not have been one of the people who were subjected to the same stringent requirement of a commissioner. For instance, if the commissioner was subjected to that type of security clearance as mentioned earlier, now you might find somebody just being appointed there who would not necessarily have gone through the same process. And 30 days in aviation, given our unfortunate situation of 9/11, I think it's too much of a window to cause chaos if we don't close this loophole. Therefore, what am I suggesting? That a revision is made of that proposal, that it subjects any person who might be eligible for that appointment to meet the requirements that were met by the commissioner, i.e. top secret security, if that is the most top. I think the technical and experience, for me, it's covered. But my biggest concern, given my earlier question, this is a very highly sensitive position, and I think we need to up the bar there. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Advocate Masombuga, as Honorable Mapena is lowering his hand, I'm sure that was a mistake. Otherwise, I'll come back to you. Honorable Mapena?
I am just sorry for that.
Thank you very much. Advocate Masombuga?
Chairperson, the comment is noted and we'll revise it.
Thank you very much, Advocate Almanel. Back to you.
Thank you, Chairperson. So we go now to Clause 21, which is an amendment of Section 94 deals with the performance agreement between the Minister, the Civil Aviation Board, and the Director, or as we've changed it now to the Commissioner. So we had 94.1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. So we've got amendments here proposed to the heading, which will just remove Director and change it to Commissioner. The same here, we'll have an amendment in sub A, the minister's requirements in respect of the Civil Aviation Authority's scope of business, efficiency, financial performance, and achievement of objectives. Then B, the principles to be followed by the Civil Aviation Authority for the purposes of business planning. An amendment to subsection 3 to now read, the Minister, the Civil Aviation Authority Board, and the Commissioner may in writing amend the performance agreement when necessary. And there's a proposal to delete subsections 4, 5, and 6. So Chair, just going here, so the reference to the Civil Aviation Board is there under A, we've got Civil Aviation Authority Board, but the proposal is to remove the reference to the board and just refer to the Civil Aviation Authority scope as a whole in its entirety. That's the same for A and B. Then just to show members the other clauses. So the proposal here further is to delete 4, 5, and 6. 4, 5, and 6. Read, the minister must publish the performance agreement in the Gazette, and any amendments thereto must be so published at least 30 days prior to that amendment coming into operation. A copy of the performance agreement must be open to inspection by the public at the head office of the Civil Aviation Authority during business hours. And six, the minister, the Civil Aviation Authority Board, and the director must, before the initiation of the performance agreements or amendment thereof, on any matter which may affect any stakeholder, consult with the relevant stakeholder or stakeholders in the aviation industry. So Chair, that then for members, and I think might assist if the department just clarifies the need to remove 4, 5, and 6 to members as well.
Thank you, Advocate. Honorable members, here we are. Ubaba Ulisa Gamani.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Followed by Umama Ufikile Khumalo. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair. I propose that we go with the recommendation of Advocate. That would have been my question. That we get clarity of why those are removed. However, I didn't seem to have a problem with subsection 6, because my view was that subsection 6, which is proposed for deletion, brings in a lot of burden on the board to consult with too many people. That is my view, but I'm interested in knowing the department's reason for the deletion. So I support that. But 6, I support its deletion. 4 and 5, I really need some clarity. Thank you, Chairperson.
Advocate Masombuga.
Thanks, Chairperson. The amendment was intended to remove provisions which have been found unnecessary to implement. I would request Mr. Mawaso to elaborate on it, if there is any elaboration.
You will request Mr. Wu.
Mabaso if he's got an input on it. But in short, the intention was to remove provisions which have been found unnecessary to implement.
Okay. Thank you. That is short to the point. Mama Fuyile Wakakumalo. Who else? Mama Ufile is connected, but it's Agakulum. Lawrence McDonald. Valerie.
Chairperson,
where are the members? Where is McDonald?
Mr. McDonald is struggling with connection, but he is online.
That's not the truth. Speak the truth. I can see here he is. If you say you don't know, I will understand you proper. There's no struggle here. There's something that we need to deal with properly and precisely as this committee. That there are members who just connect and vanish. It may not be your issue, Mashati, but I think it should be an issue of different parties, especially my own party, the African National Congress. Members must be called to order. We know Ramadwa will be on the bus. We have acknowledged that at 11:30. But Ramadwa, are you still with us?
Yes, Chairperson, but I want to move.
Thank you very much. You are disciplined, cadre of the revolution. You want to support. Boramadwa.
Yes, I'm supporting Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
I'm supporting.
Can we now move anybody who's not in agreement? Ubaba Ulisa Kamani.
Chair, no, there has not been clarity. Therefore, in the absence of clarity, I propose the reinsertion of subsection 4 and subsection 5, and I support the deletion of subsection 6. Thank you, Chair. As part. Spertela. Awa. Asbabelanga machangana la.
On a point of order.
Mkhayes, ufitile.
Can Honorable Man withdraw that, please?
Which one?
Can he withdraw what he just said?
That we should insert section 6 and section 4 and 5.
The last part, Chair, you know exactly what I'm referring to.
How are you, Honorable Member?
Chair, please do not divert my attention from what I'm talking about.
Are you good, Honorable Sutulo? I thought you were not with us. I did not hear the last part, Honorable Manu. What did you say?
We'll refer to Hansard, Chair.
Okay, let's refer to Hansard. leave us.
Thanks, Mr. Honorable Chair. The
the deletion of those is that since the act was passed, that has not happened. And then I think, well, administratively, yes, I think it probably have been a fault from the department side. But then the thing is, publishing in the Government Gazette, it comes with costs. And then we were checking what are the implications, what is the purpose of publishing the performance agreement in the Government Gazette, because basically the people who will be interested is mainly the people in the aviation space, and then making it available for inspection and for people to get a copy. We thought it was sufficient. But however, if the honorable members want us to still retain it so that we publish it in the Gazette, it will still, it's the call of the honorable committee. But then that was to explain that it was a provision which was never implemented. And when we looked at it, we found that perhaps the costs do not justify the means. Thanks, honorable chair.
You find that the costs do not justify the means?
The means, yes.
Okay, the means. What does that mean?
Well, the cost associated with that publication does not justify the purpose for which it was intended for.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. Thank you, sir. Honorable Mani.
Thank you very much. And thank you to Ntate Mabaso for that clarity. Now, I think it is common practice these days for purposes of transparency and good governance that positions similar to these, their performance contracts are made public. However, the point made about the cost, I think it's a point we can't ignore. Maybe what I could then suggest is that we retain them, but instead of the Government Gazette, we say on the website of the Civil Aviation Authority, because as he rightfully said, people who are most likely to want to know the performance contract of this particular individual are people who would be interacting with this Civil Aviation Authority website, rather than keep it very silent. That would be the slight amendment. However, I still feel we need to put them back with that slight amendment. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, happy, can we move? Can we get a seconda? Mkhayesh. Arugwe. Mkhayesh.
Isiya, Mche.
Isiya. Aglebuhe. Aglebuhe. Anybody who's having a problem with it? Thank you very much. Let's do so. Advocate Almanel.
Chair, if I dare to venture a reasoning why the publication is seen very little in the legislation these days, or the requirement to publish in the Gazette, is because exactly of the next clause we're getting to, the functions and workings and requirements in the Public Financial Management Act. Because we've got the legislative requirement for these boards and bodies to submit their annual performance plans, as well as their annual reports and their strategic plans to both Parliament, and those documents must be published on the websites and be available in stores and be available at their offices. I do know from what my memory from quite a few years back and recall in the Companies Act, there's also a requirement that copies of those documents be available for inspection at the offices that section or that requirement for it has always been there, and I think that requirement will carry on even if it's not specifically mentioned. The Companies Act might require them to do that, but that would be my explanation for the proposed deletions, Chair. But just getting on to our next clause 22, it's a slight amendment of section 95. So section 95 also refers to the application of the Public Finance Management Act. The amendment is here proposed to subsection 1, so that the new subsection 1 would read, the Public Finance Management Act applies to the Civil Aviation Authority in its entirety and not just to the board there. The old one had the reference there to the board. So Chair, the proposal is just to have it to apply to Civil Aviation Authority in its entirety, not just the board. That is our clause 22, Chairperson, for consideration to members.
Thank you, Advocate. I see a hand of Ubaba Ujambas.
Thank you once more, Chairperson. I raise my hand to support the amendment of that section 95 of clause 22. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Tate Chabangu.
Hello, sir.
Yes.
Silence means consent.
It means you agree. Thank you very much. Anybody who has an issue? Going once, twice. Back to you, Advocate. Thank you very much. Let's move. Thank you, Honorable Members.
Okay, Chair, clause 23 looks at the substitution of section 98. So this will remove the old 98 and replace it with this new proposal on the conflict of interest. So 98 had 7 subsections to it. Our new one has 8. So Chairperson, on the conflict of interest, the new clause is proposed to be no employee of the Civil Aviation Authority may engage in any paid employment or participate in any aviation activity without prior written approval of the Commissioner. The Commissioner will develop the framework and procedures to deal with conflicts. Approval referred to perform that work is valid for a period of not more than 12 months, may be renewed. Any person appointed to perform any function in terms of this act or the regulations must, in writing prior to such appointment or when conflict may occur or thereafter, annually disclose details. That's your regular financial disclosure. Chair, just again to try and save some time, similar to how we dealt with it earlier, just to put this on the screen for members to have a look at. There is also here a condition, what will happen if they fail to provide the information. And if there is an approval in terms of the section, it's open for inspection by the public, also at the offices of the Civil Aviation Authority. So Chair, that is, they have to have the disclosure of interest information available for the public and all the requirements on when they have to submit it. So if members would like, I can toggle between the old one and the new one if they would like to read through them.
Thank you, Advocate. Let's hear from the members. Members, are you happy or do you want the Advocate to scroll between the old and the new? Baba Ulisa.
Chair, thank you very much. I have gone through the new ones. Maybe if advocate could just highlight, I think she was starting to do so at the beginning, of what the old one is saying, maybe highlighting it verbatim or verbally could assist to save time. But the ones that I'm seeing that are proposed for me look very fine and straightforward, but it would be nice just to see or hear very quickly what the old ones were saying. That font advocate, even with my magnifying glasses, I'm not as endowed with good eyesight like my chairperson. even with my magnifying, yeah, that's much better. That one, my magnifying glasses are working perfect. Thanks, advocate.
Advocate?
Okay, I think you can go further down.
Okay, from... Chair, just to indicate to members, 98.1 is very straightforward. It's a lot easier to read now. It just says, look, if you want to do anything outside of your employment, you must get permission. This one is very long-winded in the old one, but it comes down to exactly the same thing. You must, in writing annually or when a conflict occurs, require this permission. If any interest that you may have, that you have declared, compromises your independence in carrying out your duties or functions, the person must dispose of such gifts. So, Chair, this is any work, any gifts that they may have received, that carries on into two. So it's not just your rig. As the declaration of financial interest will cover shareholding, gifts, properties, directorships, and the like. So Chairperson, I think the new clauses really just seek to read better. Again, there's the disclosure of interest to make sure that you stay fair, unbiased, and properly exercise your functions. Disciplinary steps can be taken if you do not comply with submitting this information. Here we have reference to your spouse, immediate family member, life partner, business associates. Then we have your partnerships and shareholdings. And a person may not be assigned, and a person may not accept or assign where there exists reason to believe such function could constitute a conflict of interest, unless full disclosure of the circumstances are made in writing, or the assignment has been approved by the director and carried out in accordance with such conditions, and then approval granted in sub 5, which is this one about your partners, is also open to inspection by the public. So, Chair, the new one has your regular conflict of interest, the time periods for what it can hold and how long it can be active. I think the new one just does not have the specifics about your partners or your spouses, but that is something that is in all the declaration of interests. And we do have the specific reference for the board memberships. I think it's also there for the commissioner that they must declare those, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate. I'm sure Honorable Manu just wanted to glance through the old one. Are you okay, Honorable Manu? Can we move?
Thank you once more, Chair. Two areas of concern to me. The issue of conflict on the proposal, not encapsulating relatives as advocate has just said. How do we circumvent that? And secondly, I hear advocate saying the issue of gifts and everything would be covered somewhere. Those are the only two concerns I have. Maybe they are, just that maybe I could just get that assurance. Spouse members close to you when it relates to conflict of interest. In my reading of the amendment or the proposed amendment, it purely talks about an employee only. I might be missing that. If that is covered, Chair, then I'm perfectly fine. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Advocate Almanel.
Chair, I think the department will be best placed here, but I do know in terms of sub 2, this is most likely where they will then end up specifying what has to be declared and how it's stored. So the framework that the commissioner will develop should deal with the procedures, terms and conditions for approval. It'll also most likely require specifics there on what must be contained in the declaration of interest. Chair, but I do get the members' concern here because sub 1 specifically refers to the engagement in paid employment or participation in aviation activity, whereas the old one specifically referred to gifts as well. So, Chair, I think the department would be best placed just to expand on this.
Baba, who leave us? I can see you smiling. You want to expand or must we give Advocate Masumbuga? Oh, Advocate Masumbuga?
Chairperson, this conflict of interest is mainly referring to a person who's employed by an employee of civil aviation who might be willing or who intends to perform remunerative work outside his scope of employment, which is CAA. And therefore, before he could do that, he must seek permission. It's not relating to when he is applying for employment, therefore he must declare a conflict of interest. So this person is already employed, and if he wants to perform other remunerative work outside his scope of employment, then he must declare. Thank you.
Thank you. What about the relatives? Does it extend to the relative? Is there any way it covers relatives of the same person, Advocate?
Chairperson, I would just have to check that, but that wouldn't be relevant to this particular section 98, because mm-hmm. that would be relevant when this person is performing a particular, when it's applying to be employed to serve in that particular institution or not. But here he is already employed and he wants to perform other remunerative work somewhere else other than where he's employed in CAA.
Okay, I hear what you're saying. Okay. Baba Ulisa Gamani.
Chair, thank you very much. Thank you, Advocate. The question we are raising in the context of what exists in the current legislation we are seeking to amend. I think what is proposed in the new or proposed amendment is very clear. However, because the Principal Act had specific reference to spouses and declaration of interest, if it's not covered in this proposed section 78, where then would it be? Because I am proposing that those particular two clauses should be highlighted somewhere to protect the Civil Aviation Authority. It might not be section 78, but I think that is the major thing that I'm raising, Chair, and I thank you once more for the opportunity.
Thank you, Advocate Masumbuga.
Chairperson, we'll locate where we can feature in what is the proposal by the Honorable Member.
Thank you very much. With that, can we then close this matter, honorable members, and move forward? Are we agreeable? Honorable Manu?
Yes, Chairperson. Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Figile.
Chairperson, we can move. I'm in agreement, Chairperson.
I was coming to you, but it's okay. I can see you are beautiful and available, and you have your tie. Thank you very much, Honorable McDonald. I'm told you did not have a network.
Yes, Chairperson, I had a serious challenge with network this morning. They stole the cables at the park in the tower this morning. So I apologize, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Okay, let's move, thank you, to the other deliberations. Advocate, we are ending here at section 90. What is the section? 98? Advocate Almanet.
Chair, we are ending on 98, clause 23, so we will move to clause 24 at the next meeting.
Clause 23, section 98. Thank you very much. Members, let me give you about 2-3 minutes just to stretch whilst we're switching on to the deliberations. That is item number 2 on the economic regulations of transport bill. That is bill number 1 of the year 2020. Thank you.
Long live the chair for his consideration. Long live.
Thank you very much. Leave us. You don't want to, 3 minutes.
Honorable chair, I just humbly request to be excused so I can take a bit of a rest for my next meeting later this morning.
Leave us. Good night. Thank you for all the endeavors. thank you for all the endeavors and commitment. I wish we can all do the same. Follow a good example of what the Canadians have taught you. Thank you very much.
No, I've been taught by yourself back home, Honorable Chair.
Okay. No, good evening, my brother. Have a nap, it's okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure. Thanks. You are responsible. You seek for permission. 3-4 minutes, honorable members. Advocate, I'm sure you are ready. Advocate.
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate, and I'm sure members are revived and we are all back.
Yes, Chair.
Indeed, Chairperson, indeed.
Thank you very much for that. Let's continue, Advocate.
Chair, I just wanted to highlight Clause 60 for members, just to remind them where we left off at the last meeting. So this Clause 60 was also discussed in one of the previous clauses when the concerns about Paya and Poppy came up. So Clause 60 allows for how they will deal when regulated entities claim that information submitted is confidential. So Chair, I'm just flagging 60 on the screen so that members are can just indicate whether they are still happy with the content of Clause 60, Chairperson.
Honorable members, if you are happy once, you can't change. You're still happy. Let's check.
Chairperson, I think we agreed that we were very happy with until that point. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Anybody who seems to have any issue going once? Tata ke mhlonishwa u Chris Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I am in agreement. I have one question. In the way that it is formulated, it sounds retrospective. In other words, it sounds as if after information has been handled in a way, it could be claimed that the information was confidential. I would suggest that it be made inclusive, that information provided to an inspector or someone appointed as an inspector, that information is regarded as confidential, as a constant rather than having it to be claimed afterwards that it is or was confidential.
I think we hear that, we all fine about that, honorable members. The suggestion by Honorable Hansinger. Can I get a supporter?
Chair, I do support.
Thank you very much, and Honorable McDonald support also. Thank you very much.
Yes, I support, Chair.
Thank you very much. Advocate Almanel, can we move?
Yes, Chair. Then going on to Clause 60. Clause 60 deals with the powers of the court. 61, Chair. So in addition to any other order that it may make under this Act or any other law, court considering a matter in terms of this Act may order a person to alter or discontinue any conduct that is inconsistent with this Act, make any order specifically contemplated in this Act, and award damages for collective injury to all or a class of persons generally to be paid on any terms or conditions that the court considers just and equitable and suitable to achieve the purposes of this Act. So, Chair, that is the powers of the court. It does mean that every person and regulated entity retains their powers to take a matter to court as well, that they are not just exhausted with the appeals process that is allowed for internally.
Thank you, honorable members. Powers of the court, are we happy If we are happy, let me see hands. If we are not happy, let me also see hands. Baba Ulisa Kamani.
Chair, thank you. It's not happiness or not being happy, but just a point of information from the good advocates here. Is it common practice that the powers of a court are, what is the right word, are mentioned here in this particular act? Yeah, that is just for of interest sake, but I don't have an issue with what is being proposed here. But I just wanted to know, is this common practice legally? So we've got so many advocates here, and we are learning in the process. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Manu. Advocate Frank Jenkins.
No, Chair, we've got a new parliamentary legal advisor. We're on the next bill, Chair.
Please introduce them to me, Advocate Alma. Otherwise, I'll mess up.
Chair, Ms. Ganging should be
please,
online.
Please, don't be too fast, please, for the Chair Advocate. Please, I'm asking. Please.
Yeah. Oh, may...
Good morning, Chair. Siloshni Gangan. Good morning.
How are you?
Members.
Yeah.
In regards to Clause 61, in certain bills they have it and in others they don't. So it really is a matter of what we want in this particular bill. The rights that the clause speaks to are in any event available to all parties, but I think for purposes of transparency and to make things easier, it is included in this bill. So it really isn't an issue that it is included in the bill. These rights are available to the public anyway and to the parties.
Thank you very much. You are welcome to this section of the meeting, Advocate. Thank you very much. Honorable Lemon.
Thank you very much. Yes, I think she put it very well that I thought these rights are there already, but seeing that there's no harm putting it there, and for purpose of progress, I support that we leave it as is. Thank you, Chairperson.
Can we get the seconder on this issue?
Seconded, Chair, Honorable MacDonald.
And Honorable Hansinger, too. Thank you very much. Advocate Almanel.
Chair, moving on to offences and penalties, Part B. Clause 62 deals with a breach of confidence. What happens if there's a breach in the information or the confidential information? So 62, it's an offence to disclose any personal or confidential information concerning the affairs of any person obtained A, in carrying out any function in terms of this act, or B, as a result of initiating a complaint or participating in any proceedings in terms of this act. Subsection 2 refers to subsection 1, does not apply to information disclosed in the following conditions: for the purpose of the proper administration or enforcement of this act, for the purpose of the administration of justice, or at the request of an inspector or regulatory authority entitled to receive the information. So, Chair, members can consider this one and link it with Clause 60 as well as the powers of the inspectors to request this information, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Let me see happiness. Or any other question? Two hands, Honorable Hansinger and Honorable Chambers.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, indeed, I would suggest that we, in light of Clause 62, that we bolster Clause 60 in describing all information as being confidential, unless has been submitted and approved by the submitter to be handled as public knowledge. And I'm referring to further extension of clause 60 in light of clause 62 then. So clause 62 is fine as it is, and this gives us a reference to clause 60 that needs to be specified that all information should be regarded as confidential unless by the submitter allowed to be used as public knowledge. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Asibonge kakhulu Mhlekazi. Ubaba uJambazi.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity given. Mine was a very cosmetic one, but I also want to comment on what my colleague has said. I agree with him, but the last part where he says the person who discloses or who supplies the information must be the one who agrees that the information can be disclosed. I think that portion, maybe my colleague could consider not including it. If section 62, subsection 2, I think does cover that, because if any person doesn't feel comfortable, they can say don't disclose anything. And yet that would be covered under 62.2. But the first part of his proposal, I do support, but would like to persuade him to relook at his further proposal that unless the person supplying the information agrees thereto, I think maybe that portion he would want to reconsider. My original raising of the hand was in the usage of the word confidence. As I said, it sounds cosmetic, but why the usage of the word confidence? And don't ask me what word would I like to use, but that word confidence just seems misplaced, or I don't know. Some other breach. I'm trying to think very hard. But the content of 62, I'm fine with it. But that word, and I don't know, maybe it's the right word that is being used. Other than that, I'm fine, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Baba Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Indeed, Chairperson, I concur with my colleague and I am in agreement. I therefore suggest my comment around the declaration or permission by the submitter to be for that to be ignored. It is well covered in 62 sub 2 and therefore I propose that we move on. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Confidence, the word confidence. Honorable Hansinger, what would you pursue your colleague to do about the word confidence?
Chairperson, I would suggest that he gives it further consideration I think within the context, it is appropriate and contextually the right word. I don't have a problem with that. Thank you, Chair.
Baba Manu?
In the spirit of persuasion, I am fine, Chairperson. Thank you, colleague. Again, as I said, it's really cosmetic, you know. The content doesn't change. And unfortunately, I couldn't think of any proposition. So therefore, Chair, yes, we can continue. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the spirit prevailing in this August house. Anybody who has an issue, we going once, twice, advocate. No.
Chair, I think just to highlight the reference to breach of confidence, it really is a legal term. that would refer to breaches of confidential agreements or any breach or leakage of so marked confidential information or information that shouldn't be shared. So it's purely a legal expression, Chair. So I hope that that will also assist with that one. Moving on to Clause 63, we look at the hindering of the administration of the Act. So hindering administration of Act, 63.1, it's an offence to hinder, oppose, obstruct, or unduly influence any person who is exercising a power or performing a duty delegated, conferred, or imposed on that person by this Act. Similar to what is stated in general aviation regulations, if you're on an aircraft, you also cannot hinder the duties of the hostesses on the aircraft or the captain. 63.2, a person commits an offence who, having been summoned, fails without sufficient cause to appear at the time and place specified or to remain in attendance until excused, or attends as required but refuses to be sworn in or to make an affirmation, or fails to produce a book, document, or other item as ordered if it is in the possession of or under control of that person. And 63.3, a person commits an offence who, having been sworn in or having made an affirmation, fails to answer any question fully to the best of that person's ability, subject to section 56(4) and 56(5), or gives false evidence knowing or believing it to be false. Just to quickly go to 56(4) and 56(5) for members. So 56(4) is a person questioned by the registrar or by an inspector or investigator conducting an investigation must answer each question truthfully to the best of their abilities. And then 5, the no self-incriminating answer given or statement made by any person or given in evidence to the regulator, inspector, investigator will be admissible as evidence against that person in criminal proceedings, against that person instituted in any court, except in criminal proceedings for perjury. So Chairperson, that just links both 63 and our next clause that will come to 64D to these two clauses. So Chair, that this clause will bolster the regulator and the inspector's ability to perform their inquiries. So, Chair, that one is now for members to consider.
Members, back to you to consider. Let me see your hand as we are doing our consideration. Advocate Nell, who is Alan Chikamvi?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard the name before. I know we have members here from state law advisors and our parliament legal guys. I know the department officials are here, but the person might have to clarify, Chair.
That they make it. It's good.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Good morning to all. Alan Chikamvi is one of my colleagues here in the department, who's working with us on the Economic Regulation Transport Bill. It's indeed a recognizable person. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Honorable Chris Hunsinger and Honorable Manu.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I'm particularly looking at 63 sub 3 sub A. We reference in terms of non-compliance or failure or interruption of an investigation is referenced by section 56 sub 4 and sub 5, but I miss what is expressed as also being a transgression under 63 sub 1. So my suggestion then would be to also under 63 sub 3 sub A include what is expressed in 63 sub 1, so that it also is an offence to hinder, oppose, obstruct, and unduly influence any person. That must, in my view, also be an offence. Thank you, Jane.
Okay. Thank you, Honorable Member Jambas.
Chair, thank you very much. I was raising at the time to support the proposal with my colleague having proposed that additional one. I think it makes sense. It expands more. It doesn't do any harm. And I therefore do support that proposal. And generally, if it's acceptable, the whole provision as presented. Thank you, Chair.
Mabongo Mhleka, senkosi kakhulu. Amathokoza mhlonishwa ubaba uMaphele.
Well, thank you so much, Chairperson. I think no, I'm good. I think with regards to 53B subsection 1 and subsection 2. And also 63 subsection 2 A and B, but with emphasis on A. So I think on those ones, as Honorable Mango has said, I think it's acceptable with the addition that Honorable Chris Hansinger has made. And I think with our current conditions in the country, 63 2A, we should place serious emphasis on that so that people can appear as and when they are asked to.
Okay, thank you very much. And that make it. Very good about your lens, hombre. Lower your hand otherwise. Thank you very much. Advocate, can we move? Thank you.
Clause 64 deals with offences relating to regulator and council. So 64, a person commits an offence who does anything calculated to improperly influence the regulator concerning any matter connected with an investigation, does anything in connection with an investigation that would have been contempt of court if the proceedings had occurred in a court of law, knowingly provides false information to the registrar or counsel, willfully interrupts the proceedings or misbehaves in the place where a hearing is being conducted, acts contrary to a warrant to enter and search or without authority, but claiming to have authority in terms of section 53, enters or searches premises or attaches or removes an article or document. So Chair, at least 64F will avoid fraudsters trying to rely on the role of an investigator or inspector for purposes of getting their hands on information that they are not allowed to get. Chair, that is clause 64 for members.
Advocate, thank you very much for stopping there and allowing members to air their views. Members, let's go. Happy? Happy.
My hand is up, Chair.
Yes, Honorable Manu.
Thank you, Chair. I just seek the intent of clarity of subsection B. The rest I'm fine. I don't seem to understand what we are trying to say. In the same way that Advocate explained F, could we do the same with B? Just to break it down for me, simply, please.
Okay, Honorable Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I concur with my colleague, Honorable Mandu, but in particular for me, Section 64 sub F is problematic, given that we are talking of premises, in practical terms, maybe storerooms, where employees generally have access to. So at what stage do you then declare that particular premises as limited? as a attaining a particular status given the announcement of the investigation, then not to be accessible for people that normally through their employment would have access. So yes, it becomes very technical, but legislation is technical. So particularly the 64 sub F, I've got a problem with in maybe further definition needs to be included so that a particular stage and status then declares a particular access would be needed to enhance that section. But at this stage, I can see practical and operational problems there.
Okay, thank you very much. It means we must give a bit of a meat when it comes to section 4A subsection F. That's what the honorable member is saying. Advocate Alma.
Chair, I'm just going up to 53 because we cannot do 64F without reading 53. 53 refers to reviews and reports by the regulator. So we just need to make sure that it is the right cross-reference as well. We'll need to get the department just to give clarity there, because to me it almost seems like it's not the correct cross-reference. Because this to me is supposed to be for the inspectors having their search and seizure powers, where 53 then talks about reviews and reporting instead of the search and seizure powers. But I do get Mr. Hunsinger's point, because one can argue that if we do look at 64F, there is the pre-requirement here that it's only persons that are entering without authority. In normal aspects, your employees may have authority, but it is quite quite necessary in some instances if there is a concern that some employees might damage or hide or destroy the information that the inspectors and investigators may need to acquire. That there may be a need to expand on what stages that is. But I do think the legal drafters and the team will just have to make sure that this cross-reference is to the correct section, Chairperson. So I would like them to come in here and help members to clarify those issues.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think there is a typo there. That 53 should have been 55, the whole of 55, which is the section that talks to inspectors and investigators and all that stuff. So I think the typo has been made that it should be 55, Chair, through you. Thank you.
Will we then put some meat when it comes to 64, subsection 1, subsection F?
Indeed, Chair, we've noted the comments, particularly on 64F. So indeed, we will engage and make sure that it is clarified, as suggested, about making sure that we talk about the stages at which the declaration is made on that area. Thank you, Chair.
64F. I can hear that emphasis. Thank you very much. Can we now move? We are in agreement.
Chair, my clarity, please, on 64B. Okay. What are we trying to say there?
Oh, sure. The delegates.
I've noted that, Chair. Can I get 1 minute to reflect on it and then I'll give feedback as well?
Normally, we are strict on time, but 1 minute will not kill a cat.
Chair, if I could possibly assist, 64B also links up with the hindering of administration of the Act. So, for example, you will be in contempt of court because the specific reference here is your actions are hindering the investigation as if you would be in contempt of court. So that would normally be if you do not supply the information as is subpoenaed or required and requested there by the investigators, as well as instances where you give false information or you fail to answer questions or at least fail to answer questions that would not be self-incriminating questions. Chair, this is how I would understand 64B.
That is good. Your minute is over.
Chair, I think I'm well covered by Advocate Nell.
Advocate Nell, were you covering that is Kudo?
Chair, that was my attempt on explaining how I understand 64B. If it covers the concern, I think Mr. Mantlu will be better to say if he's covered.
Oh. Honorable Mantlu, are you covered?
Chen, no, not really, but I can live with it. Because the assumption is that everybody will know what would have been contempt of court, you know? But I guess it is more towards the regulator. I was just hoping that it would not refer to somewhere else. It will deal with this act and what the person would have committed an offense, you know, because the heading says offenses relating to regulator and counsel, you know. But not being a legal person, with that explanation of the advocate, I'm prepared to live with it, and reluctantly so. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Can we move to Clause 65.
Chair, I did see Mr. Hunsinger's hand is up just before we...
Okay, thank you for assistance, Baba Hunsinger.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, Honorable Mantlu has now sensitized a focus on this contempt of court issue. Now, as I understand it, contempt of court normally refers to injury on the dignity and respect of a judicial system. And I'm not so sure that this particularly sort of grasps what we want to do here. So maybe we should rather consider what we want to achieve with this sub B, rather than to accept the phrasing, because contempt of court is something very specifically, as I said, it refers to injury on the dignity and respect of court. So I'm not sure whether that is, because that's rather wide and maybe too wide and too specified in terms of status, because yes, I mean, for obvious reasons. So I think we should reconsider that. Thank you, Chair.
It means Honorable Mantlu, somebody who has now backed improperly, reluctantly so. So that has to be rephrased. Thank you. We can live with that. Advocate.
Chair, our parliamentary legal advisor's hand was also up, as well as Mr. Mantlu.
You know why I'm missing them? It's because they shift, or I must shift on my side here. Mubaba Ul. Frank Jenkins, Oh, no, no longer. Baba Frank is now...
it's 12 hours.
Tilosin Kangen.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I just wanted to add that we could look at rephrasing that and possibly refer to an obstruction as opposed to how the clause is currently worded, referring to the court process. So we can definitely rephrase, look at rephrasing that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. For as long as you are not bringing an injury to the dignity of the phrasing of clause 64B. Thank you very much, Mayor Tilosin. You see, now I'm talking legal terms. Advocate Almanel, 65.
Chair, I'm going to do 65 and 66 together. 65 offences relating to prohibited conduct. It's an offence to fail to act in accordance with a compliance notice. And 65.2, a regulated entity may not be prosecuted for an offence under subsection 1 if the regulator has already imposed a price control reduction in terms of section 21 for the particular failure to satisfy a compliance notice. And then 66 on penalties. Any person convicted of an offence in terms of this act is liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 5 years, or to both a fine and imprisonment. Despite anything to the contrary contained in any other law, a magistrate's court has jurisdiction to impose any penalty provided for in this section. So, Chair, those two then before we go on to miscellaneous matters.
Miscellaneous matters. Okay. Let me open my scorecard. Ubaba Ulisa Gamangu.
Thank you, Chairperson. With your indulgence, can I quickly check with Advocate if a regulated entity is defined? And if it is, if we could just be reminded of it, then we can read the context properly. Thank you, Chair. Then that would be able to assist me to conclude any comment. Thank you, Chair.
Very much. Thank you very much. Advocate, please assist us. Advocate Almanel.
Chair, highlighted on the screen is the definition proposed for regulated entity.
An entity to which this act applies in terms of A, section 4, subsection 1, or B, a declaration contemplated in section 4, subsection 2.
Yes, Chair, then just going to the relevant 4, 1 and 2. There we go, application of the act. 4.1, subject to any exemptions contemplated in subsection 7 to 9. This act applies to any market, entity or facility in the transport sector that was immediately before the effective date subject to economic regulation by the minister. And 2, the minister in consultation with the regulator by notice in the Gazette may declare that this act applies to any market or any entity or facility irrespective whether privately or state owned within the transport sector if the minister has determined that either of the following circumstances apply. A single operator controls more than 70% of the market concerned, or the preconditions for efficiency and cost effectiveness do not exist in the market concerned. Just going down to those subsections 7 and 9. 7 again looks to possible exemption of entities from this regulation. And 9 also looks at withdrawal of notices. So, Chair, I hope that assists with the definition of a regulated entity.
Advocate, thank you very much. Baba Ulisa, Wawa Chambers.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Advocate. for that assistance. Now, my question is, why then do we want to exempt once more like the previous 64? What is the intent or intention of 65.2? Says a regulated entity, which we have just clarified now, may not be prosecuted for an offense under subsection 1 if the regulator has already imposed a price control reduction in terms of section 21 of the particular failure to satisfy a compliance notice. So I am struggling to get to understand what, again, if it could be simplified, what are we trying to achieve with this exemption in subsection 2? Because it's exempting subsection 1, which is, it is an offense to fail to act in accordance with the compliance notice. Full stop, I fully agree. Then why are we going into 2? And section 66 penalties, I'm in full agreement with. If I could get that explanation, Chair, that would assist. I thank you once more.
Thank you very much, Honorable Manu. Let's go to Ubaba Uketa Amabala Wagwastole. Mondiz?
Thank you, Chair. I think the question that has been asked by Honorable Mango is covered me, because I was trying to check the clarity on that one. If the regulator has been already imposed a price control reduction in terms of section 21 for the particular failure to satisfy a compliance notice, I was trying to check if they can actually unpack it on, but the question are the same like what Honorable Mango has been asked. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mondise. Honorable Hansing, I can see you want to ask a question. Can we come to you? What are you saying, sir?
Chairperson, I must put these sections next to each other. It appears that we have a negative loop here. And it would have to be dissected and again, maybe repurposed in terms of what we want to achieve. Because I think we are overlapping at least three objectives, and I think they should be. Clustered together rather than to try and make a poiky course out of it here at the end. They say when you get tired of numbering, you then throw in a miscellaneous matters. So I think miscellaneous matters must go a little bit lower in the document, and we should then probably describe and distinguish between the different objectives here, because clearly there are two or three objectives that in a way overlaps here and therefore creates the confusion. So it's technical in nature, but I think it must be reworked, but certainly not impossible, because all the ideas are captured here, but the different lines are now not clear since it's been all sort of grouped into one, particularly with a cross-referencing. So I think if one would technically group all of them in terms of the different objectives, we would get clarity, and it might need a additional part and that miscellaneous matters must move down a bit. So yes, Lung, thank you, Nklegas.
Thank you.
Yes, Honorable Chair.
Okay, Emre.
Getting one okay.
Ah, get the way.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah, I understand that.
There is a suggestion that we should rework properly 65 and 66. Are you getting that clearly?
Yes, Chair. In terms of the reworking proposal, it is clear from our side. However, I may have lost it when a recommendation was made that there are three objectives to be achieved here, which I would probably request details on those ones, on those three objectives which are being observed here. Secondly, I think the main intention of 65.2 is to ensure that a regulated entity that has caused an offense may not be penalized twice.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you look at 65.1, it basically says when there is a prohibited conduct by a regulated entity in general terms, there will be a compliance notice. However, that compliance notice will only apply if a price control reduction was not imposed to the regulated entity. That's in a nutshell what it aims to do, basically to avoid double penalizing the regulated entity. In certain instance, the compliance notice may have a declaration to say the entity would be penalized through a price control reduction, which would be affecting the revenue of the organization. So you wouldn't want to double penalize a company for a similar offense. That's really the intention. I think, Chair, again, I have acknowledged the recommendation here. Probably with the legal people, we will work around that. Probably we can get additional information on the objectives that Honorable Hamsinger is thinking about. We can then build the two sections to an appropriate level. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honorable Hansinger, you wanted to give a bit of meat?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Already in the explanation that we just got, it is much clearer. So I think that must then just be described, you know, within legal terminology, because that already distinguishes the objectives. So three streams which I think that in a way overlap and cause grey area here is the price control reduction intention, the compliance notice, and then the penalty upon certain conditions that are not. So those are, to me, are the three streams. And in a way, they've sort of cross-lined here. But as I say, I think it's within the current framework of thinking to then clearly distinguish the three and categorize and classify them. But as it is, obviously it needs more description, but in the words that's been used now by the department, it's more clear than what it's written here. So a bit of refinement would get us there. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Ndadeye Skudo, you clear now?
Very much so, Chairperson. Thank you so much, Honorable Hansinger.
Thank you very much. Advocate Almanel, 67.
Yes, Chair, I will move to 67 now. I just wanted to remind members, or just pull them back to Section 20, because Section 20 will indicate the different kinds of compliance notices. So it could be for price reductions or for other reasons that they need to comply. So that just to, if members would just like to have a read through there as we carry on with the business. 67, getting on to miscellaneous. 67, clause 67 deals with civil actions and jurisdiction. So, Chair, if an agreement, a provision of an agreement or a notice to which a transaction or agreement is purported to be subject is, in terms of any provision of this Act considered void, that agreement, provision or notice must be regarded as being of no force or effect at any time, unless a court has declared that the relevant provision of this Act does not apply to the impugned agreement, provision or notice. A person who has suffered loss or damage as a result of prohibited conduct or dereliction of required conduct may not assert a claim in a civil court for the assessment of the amount or awarding of damages if that person has consented to an award of damages in a consent order, or if entitled to commence an action referred to in paragraph A, when instituting proceedings must file with the registrar or clerk of court a notice from the chairperson of the council in the prescribed form, certifying whether the conduct constituting the basis for the action has been found to be prohibited or required conduct in terms of the Act, stating the date of the council finding, if any, and setting out the section of this Act in terms of which the council made its finding, if any. 3, a certificate referred to in subsection 2B is conclusive proof of its contents. 4, an appeal application for review against an order made by the council in terms of this Act suspends any right to commence an action in the civil court with respect to the same matter unless the court orders otherwise. So, Chairperson, I'm just going to pause there before I go to the limitations of bringing an action.
Thank you, Advocate. Let me go back to my screen and see hands. Ubaba Ulisa Kaman Gajambas.
Thank you very much, Chair, for the opportunity once more. I'm seeking clarity here. It would appear to me that we are saying here, and this is subject to correction, should anybody who has been acted upon through this Act, should that acting upon be found to be wrong, or they feel it is wrong, we are protecting them from taking any action against us in a civil court or otherwise. That is what I seem to be getting to be the bottom line here. And I'm not sure if I'm correct. As I said, I'm subject to correction. However, should I be correct in my assertion, could I understand as to why we are taking that route? Thank you very much. That is my point where I would like to get correction, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Jambas. Baba Keta Mabala, wakwasithole.
Ndodana Ramondis.
Amvuyo.
Hey, I'm checking this clause 67. Clause 67 2A, which says may be asserted a claim in a civil court for the assessment of the amount or awarding of damage if that person has consented to an award of damage in a consent order. I'm trying to check here, Chairperson, if a person has been underpaid, it means that he cannot actually challenge for the other payment on the damage of his property, if I see that like that one, because I don't know, or sometimes I'm reading it wrong, if they can actually help me, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Advocate Almaner, please help my people.
I think the department can just highlight in terms of the memorandum what the purpose is for this clause. This is normally just to look at protecting against civil claims. So if, for example, an order said that they must reduce their fares by a certain amount, but let's say later on it was found on review that the formula used might have been incorrect, then they will get, since they gave a consent order to make that order, they will not be able to go to court for a civil claim against the council or the regulator. But I think it's best for the department just to clarify here, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think from where I sit, Chair, we would have to reflect on this area because it needs some legal minds. Because it's an area that was basically advised to us that we need to have it in the Act, but the context and the content in which it is captured here, to be honest, I'm not quite sure. So I don't want to mislead the committee here, but we would reflect on it and then respond on the questions that have been made, Chair, if you allow me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir, for your honesty. You are a good man. Advocate Alma, what do we do in the case where the department is still going to reflect?
Chair, we do still have time because this is all still part of the deliberations. And there might be consequential amendments later on as well. But Chair, we're not at the final point of clause by clause, so members will still have the opportunity to get the clarity requested from the department before we get to the consideration of the A list and the clause by clause of the bill. So there is still time to give so that the department can make sure that members understand it completely, and if there's a need to rephrase it, that can be done so that it's also more understandable for the ordinary reader, Chair.
We can just highlight that so that we don't forget it, Advocate, and move on. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much for that. And I hope another...
You are muted, Chair.
Wow. Somebody's muting me when I've not muted myself.
Chair, apologies, it's me. I'm trying to mute Mr. Sithole. apologies.
Thank you very much to hear your voice, Valerie, back in action. Thank you very much. I would have muted Mr. Sithole, Honorable Sithole myself. I know the reason why you are muting me. Advocate, Section 68, Clause 68, limitations of bringing action. Please don't.
The dog is awake now because the gardeners are coming. So.
No, I'm just requesting Valerie nicely not to mute you also. Wow. Okay, let's go, Advocate.
Okay, Chair. I'm just getting the grandma to move the dog to an undisclosed location. 68 is the limitations of bringing action.
I ignore that dog. He's doing its job also. It's getting busy to do what he's doing, Advocate.
She's a very good guard dog and extremely jealous. Chairperson 68, limitations of bringing action. A complaint may not be referred or made more than 3 years after the act or omission that is the cause of the complaint. The date on which the regulator became aware or ought reasonably to have been aware of the cause of the complaint, or in the case of a course of conduct or continuing practice, the date that the conduct or practice ceased. 68.2, a complaint may not be referred against any person who is or has been a respondent in proceedings under another section of this Act relating substantially to the same conduct. So Chair, 68.1 really is just the regular prescription of what you would have for civil matters, which is 3 years. If you do have an issue, it does need to come within that time and be directed.
Thank you very much, Advocate. Honorable Akbar Liede, Akbar Ketamabala, Stole,
thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Chair, if they can actually educate me on 68.2, where they say the complaint may not be referred against any person who is not or who is or has been respond in positing.
Respondent
in a position under another section of this act, reacting to substantially to the same conduct. If that one can, if they can actually unpack that one. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Ubaba Ulisa. Come on. Chair,
thank you, Chair. I can stand down, Chair, until my colleague has received his explanation. Otherwise, I was going to move that we accept, but I'm withdrawing that subject to him getting the clarity seeker. Thank you, Chair. I'm standing down for now.
Thank you very much for that legal jargon. I'm standing down here. We are educated here. Advocate Almanel.
The department can provide clarity, or our legal drafters can provide clarity. It's just, as I would understand it, it's so that you don't bring two actions related to the same conduct at the same time. But I think they can just give some clarity, Chair.
Honorable Chair, it's exactly the same, but to add to say you don't use different sections of this act to basically against a respondent on a similar conduct, Chair. Thank you.
Am I correct if I'm saying you said is it double punishment?
It could be a long list of issues by applying different sections of the Act, Chair.
Oh, okay.
Yes, on one similar conduct or prohibited conduct, Chair. Thank you.
Jobe, Kamacha, we have some point. Stand up. The last time I was talking to you, you were standing. You were proposing to stand down.
My apology. You just got cut. With my colleague having accepted the explanation, I propose Section 68 to be accepted as is. Thank you, Chair.
You were actually seconding Ucho Obeba.
Amanda.
Thank you very much. Anybody who has a problem with section clause 68, I'm told it's not. Thank you very much. Advocate Almanel.
Clause 69 is the serving of documents. Unless otherwise provided for in this act, a notice, order, or other document that, in terms of this act, must be served upon a person will deem to have been properly served when it has been hand-delivered to that person, sent by electronic mail to that person's email address, or delivered by registered mail to that person's registered address. So, Chair, that this also, the use of the electronic mail is linked to the reference that we have a little bit earlier in the Act to the Electronic Communications and Transactions Act that does allow for the official serving of notices, summonses, and official documents via email. So, Chair, I'm just going to pause there before we get to our last two clauses and the schedule.
You make my heart jump out of my skin. Thank you, Advocate. Let's hear what the members are saying. Honorable Hunsinger, followed by Honorable Stolle.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a quick question. Is that person defined? Or do we want to make it as wide as what it is formulated? Who is that person?
Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Baba Keta Mabal.
Thank you, Chair. I'm trying to check the time frame of delivering of notices. Because if you say it has been properly served, when it has been hand delivered to their person. So now I'm trying to check the time frame of delivery. Is that a month? Is that 2 months? Is that 7 days? Is that 14 days? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Baba Ujobe. Baba Hunsinger, do you want to come back? It was a mistake that your hand is up.
No, it's never a mistake, Chairperson. Thank you. Chairperson, and I'll lower my hand now. Chairperson, just in addition to that, we are dealing with a regulator here. So who then represents the regulator in terms of that person? So is it then furthermore regarded as having been delivered to the regulator upon delivery of documents or whatever to a representative within the regulator's organizational structure? So that then again poses the question which I did at the beginning, just to rationalize it a bit. Who is that person? And is that person defined? And does that person then mean anyone within the organization, thereby representing the regulator? Because we're talking of an individual at the end of the day, and we're talking of the organization. Thank you.
Okay. Advocate Almanel.
Chair, just to flag, the definition in the bill for person includes a juristic person. So the persons we are normally talking about here would be the regulated bodies or persons or entities. I do think the department and the drafters can just come in whether or not it would be advisable to use the reference to person, even though it does include juristic persons. But if there isn't a better phrasing, but this clause speaks to the serving of documents by the regulator. This would be an action that is performed by the regulator in terms of informing other persons of what they are required to do or what they are required to present, as one would in terms of subpoenaing or summoning persons and requesting them to deliver documents or information, Chair. But I think the drafters and the department can just clarify whether or not the use of on a person is the best possible wording there, Chair.
And then the issue of time frame is actually not an issue here, because we explaining the legality of the serving of documents. Am I correct?
Yes, Chair, as far as I would understand it, but each action, for example, the instituting or the submitting of notices, instituting of appeals, higher up in the Act, they do have their own timeframes linked to them. So, for example, if the regulator is required to submit the outcome of a report within 30 days, then that is what the time frame is there. If an investigation is instituted and must be finalized within a specific time frame, then obviously this serving of documents would have to be within those time frames to get the information. I'm not sure. Sometimes there are some clauses that would link a time frame to receipt of an email, but that might be covered in the Electronic Transaction and Communications Act. But we can hear from the department and the legal advisors.
Thank you,
Chair. Yeah. I think I've noted 2 points, Chair, the issue around time frame and the issue around person, as to have we defined that. Obviously, Advocate Nand has alluded to the fact that it has been defined in the Act. As the way she has explained it, that's how we're having it. However, there's a good twist that Honorable Hunsinger is bringing around differentiating between the regulator and the individual. Maybe it's a matter that we can look at, Chair, when we are looking at Section 67. And on the time frame as well, I think if the Honorable Committee members would want us to be in detail as to the exact time frame of delivery and the exact time frame of acknowledgement of receipt and all that stuff, I think we can do that as well. But obviously we look at other legislations as to how they phrase this together with the Electronic Transaction Act as well, Chair. I think it's something that we can look at and come back, Chair, on it together with Section 67. Thank you, Chair.
You are not at your sharpest today in the Dimigis. Maybe I'm a bit tired.
Can I make a disclaimer, Chair?
Yes, make a disclaimer. I'm happy to hear your disclaimer.
As an honest person, I'm not a legal person. Some of these I'm guided by legal people. So when I respond, I should be careful as well as to what do I say and try to get an opportunity to actually reflect on most of these issues, because most of these sections, Chair, they affect each other. I may comment in a particular direction in one section, but you may find that I have it not in the other section. And it's important to reflect on those, Chair.
I'm happy for that disclaimer. Where is Advocate Masombo?
Chairperson, I'm here. And yes. Good afternoon, good day once more. This particular section refers to the method of service. When can we say a person has been correctly legally served with a document? Either be it a summon or a warrant. Within the document that will be served on a person, there will be a time frame within which that person is supposed to react or to appear if it is a summon. If it's summoned to appear in that document or in that summon, it will indicate as when it's supposed to appear before that particular authority that is summoning him. There's no need for time frame here. And a person is properly, this is the most best possible way of utilizing the word a person. It will be a person that is, will be served with it, with that particular document. Thank you.
That is why I had to raise this issue, because that's how I understand it. Unless otherwise provided for in this Act, a notice, order, or other document that in terms of this Act must be served on a person, and they will be deemed to have been properly served when it has been served in the following manner. One, hand delivered to that particular person. Number two, which is B, sent by electronic mail to that person or email address, or delivered by a registered mail to that person's registered address. So these three methods are considered legally correct. You shall have served that person, and I'm sure in that particular letter or email or so, time frames would have been included. But here, we're not talking time frames. We're talking legal methods of serving. Am I correct, Advocate Alma?
Yes, Chair.
Thank you very much. And then Advocate Masombuka says, here we're talking about a person, the one body, not an institution, not a jurisdiction.
No, chairperson. A person refers also to juristic persons, whether it be human beings or juristic persons, companies or partnerships. Thanks.
So when we say, unless otherwise provided on this act, a notice or order or other document that in terms of this act must be served on a person, we are also mentioning all those persons we have talked about. Advocate, am I correct?
Yes, correct, Chairperson.
Thank you very much.
Those were Chairperson that says unless otherwise. They mean if the legislation specify any other method other than those specified here, then this will be regarded as the most legally viable method of service of any document to a person, whether it be a juristic person or a natural person.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, let me go back to you. Are we happy? Can we move, Honorable Hansinger?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, firstly, to Mr. Sekudu, I'm thinking you are doing just well, sir. Nothing wrong with anything in terms of contribution giving more detail. Chairperson, with regards to this particular clause 69, fully in agreement with the description, what we have on paper is correct, and it's fine. The problem is with what is defined as that person, and I think that should be refined. And we should further expand on not the method, because the method is 100% correct. We are fully in agreement with the method and the three specifications here. What we have a concern about is who the appropriate representative person would be that is demanded action of and that needs to follow on the prescription or caution or fine or penalty that is imposed. So that person should be aligned to a particular body of authority within that organization so that it actually lands with the right person in the organization, so that that person isn't the first person that would be approached, but that it's more specific, because we're talking of particular loss of income, we're talking of implications for the organization. So therefore, we've got to look from both sides and not just from the regulator side, so that an organization can also have the assurance that through the additional clauses that might be added to this, that any documentation will be submitted to the correct person, which is a formal representative of the organization and not just any person. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Lansinga. I think that is clear. Honorable Advocate Masombuka, you are clear.
I'm clear, Chairperson, but from the practical perspective, now how are we going to define every person who's authorized by his company to be the person who will be receiving method of service? A summon, when it's issued to a person, it specifies as to who is summoned at court. Then that person or his representative or the head of that institution must receive that. It's going to depend as to in that institution, who have, for instance, if there is a traffic fine or a traffic ticket for a government vehicle, In the department, there are transport officers, but it will be referred to the head of the department, who will in turn give it to the proxy, who is the transport officer within the department, to deal and locate as to who was utilizing that particular vehicle. Thank you.
Thank you. I like the spirit with which we are engaging on this matter. Honorable Hansinger.
Thank you, Chairperson, and Advocate Masombo, I appreciate the example. It is a good example. But also, please see it from the organization side, and that it is possible to discover the delivery of a particular very important document in the hands of a wrong person a couple of months, and then having to deal with the consequence of not knowing this. So I would imagine that there is a particular process in terms of communication and interaction before a final decision is made of a transgression notice or something of that nature. So through that process, certainly, it can be determined who represents that organization. And therefore, it should be that person that would have to receive it. So I would therefore recommend that we just refine it a bit and we link it to the procedure in terms of interaction and communication through the investigation and through the establishment of facts in the conversation around whether there is a transgression or not. That in that process, in that phase, a particular identification is made of who the person is that should ultimately be summoned or the receiver of this notice. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. let's hear Mayor Tilosin Kangen. Mayor Tilosin, are you still with us?
I am, Chair. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Can you have a say on this one?
I'm in agreement with this clause, Chair. And I think that in terms of time frames, it's dealt with in terms of the other clauses. Chair, can you hear me, Chair? You're breaking up a bit.
I can hear you loud and clear. Advocate?
Chair?
Yes, I'm listening.
So I have nothing further to add other than what was already said, Chair.
Ademirgates.
Through you, Chair. May we be given an opportunity to reflect on this matter, because the matters which are raised are genuine. I can give another example where certain people are staying in an estate and a document will be delivered to a security personnel at the estate, and that would be taken as it has been delivered officially. Is it correct when a person who stays inside the estate has not actually received that document? Let's reflect on it. It doesn't hurt. We will probably learn a lot out of it if we do an exercise correctly there as to how do we then deal with the practical issue around it and then take it from there, Chair. That's probably my advice, given the fact that we still have time to look at other sections, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let's then step off this item. I think Honorable Hansinger will leave with that. Happily so. Thank you very much. Advocate Alma Nell.
Chair, I just want to check with you. I think we've run out of time, but if Chair would want us just to do 70 and 71, they are really standard and straightforward. I don't think 7... Okay. Chair 70 deals with consequential amendments, so we'll have to look at the schedules probably at the next meeting to make sure that all those are covered. And 71 just explains the short title and commencement. Those are very standard clauses, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. Let's hear Honorable Yabo. Magdi? McDonald is no longer here also. Honorable Ramadwa? Wow. Mkhayesu? Honorable Seitholo, are you here?
It seems we are all gone, Jane.
That is a very high standard of discipline. If people can just live like that. Honorable Mapena, are you still here?
Chairperson, I'm here. I think
you are very disciplined, I know. Can you ask us, what are you saying here on the 1771?
Chairperson, I submit that the members were gone all along and that we only discovered it now. So I think we must then reconsider everything.
Wow. Yeah, no?
Chairperson, I received so much information today. I'm looking for a place to store it.
So you
colleagues, I think we must vote on something now.
No, man, please, man. In our culture to vote on
Well, Chairperson, I think as the good advocate, Alamanel, deposited that these aren't really major changes, and that she would want us to maybe, it's almost like for noting of some sort. But if our colleagues have some major contributions, I don't have a problem, but I think I'll align myself with what Advocate Nell had said, also given the issues of time.
Thank you very much, Mshonishwa. Akbare Pitmei. Okay.
Chairperson, I support the proposal and in the spirit of wanting to complete this session, I propose that we proceed and accept.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, we stop here on clause 71, subsection 2, chapter 6. Dealing with general provisions. I note that. Can we quickly run to the minutes?
Chair, can I kindly ask you to defer that to next week's meeting? There is a subcommittee meeting coming up, and I am worried that I won't be able to open the link in time because I cannot do it if this meeting is still ongoing.
I support that proposal, Chair. Some of us are involved with a subcommittee meeting and we need to have a short one to overlap, please, Chair.
Wow. Valeria, we are ruining my meeting, but it's okay.
I'm really worried about the next one, Chair. Really worried because of the technology. It doesn't allow me to overlap.
No, it's okay, Valeria. I think members support it.
Valeria is very progressive.
It's okay, Valerie. You must note that you are very progressive when it comes to defying the chair. It's okay. It's okay. Honorable members, I think we have done a lot within a short space of time. We really need to look into issues of discipline. I am raising that matter properly as the chair for parties to deal with that matter. If members have not apologized, they should be in a meeting. And I want to thank everybody and the spirit with which we have been handling the issues today. I'm sure we are going forward and we will be able to complete what we have started. Having said that, let me liberate members who are going to a subcommittee. I've read your minutes. You are doing well. We are looking forward to a full report back to the portfolio committee as you are answerable to us. Otherwise, long live everybody that has been here today. Everybody, as I say, everybody. Thank you. You are released. Thank you.
Thank you.